This is The Takeaway. I'm Anna Sale, in for John Hockenberry. Thanks so much for listening. Today, Oxford Dictionaries announces the word of 2013. It's a word I even cringe to say. Selfie.
My God.
We'll talk about the value of this latest form of photography and whether it's legitimate art, just narcissism, or something in between. Plus, later this hour, more about the twin bomb attacks on the Iranian embassy in Beirut. And we'll take a look at a new law in Missouri that changes the rules for lethal injection just before a man on death row is scheduled to be executed. But we begin this hour with the continuing efforts to put the Affordable Care Act back on track and a new report that the administration was never in position to go live on October 1st to begin with. According to newly released documents from House investigators, senior Obama administration officials, including several in the White House, were warned by the management consultant McKinsey that the effort to build healthcare.gov was falling behind and was at risk. The analysis had been requested by the White House, but the White House seemingly chose to ignore its findings. Senator Angus King is an independent from Maine. In the first month of open enrollment, fewer than 300 people in Maine signed up using the federal website. Senator King has long been a supporter of the Affordable Care Act, but earlier he told me there is no excuse for the rollout to be as sloppy as it's been.
Execution is as important as vision. And in this case, I think the vision was the right one. I think the execution has not been adequate, but I think it's important to realize that the promise of this act, the key to it, is providing more available health care coverage to more people, and that's really important. There are varying estimates, but between 25 and 45,000 people a year die in the United States because they don't have insurance coverage, simply because they don't have insurance coverage. I think that's something that we ought to be doing something about. If all those people died in one town at one time, we'd be doing backflips to do something about it. And so the underlying premise of the law, I think, makes sense in the whole idea of the online marketplace. And it is complicated. I mean, if you go back and look at just at recent history, the rollout of the drug benefit under Medicare back in about, I think it was 2004, 2005. I can remember at the time there were headlines. It was just a disaster. The website didn't work. People couldn't figure it out. Seniors were confused and angry. So it's a big project. It's going to take some time, but they need to keep working to make it right. And ultimately, I think it is going to be helpful to a lot of people. I'm still a supporter of the law, but that doesn't mean I can't be critical of the way they've done the implementation thus far.
I want to move on to the budget, because that's another place where we've seen an inability of Congress to come together and reach consensus. We've just keep coming back to the brink and coming up with short-term patches. You've tried to lead a conversation out of that stalemate, but there doesn't seem to be much optimism in any corner in Washington that we're anywhere near any kind of long-term solution. When you look at it, I mean, the numbers just don't seem to be there politically, right? So how do you even start that conversation?
No, it's really hard. And let me share with you something. There was a graph I saw recently in one of the major newspapers that talked about the vanishing middle in the Congress. And in 1982, the space between the most liberal Republican and the most conservative Democrat included 344 members of Congress. The overlap, there were such a thing as moderate to liberal Republicans, there were conservative Democrats. Yeah, but the overlap was 344 members of Congress. Today, it's 11. And what that means is there's no center. Everybody's on one side or the other, and that's one of the things that makes these things so hard to settle. We can do things on the margin in less contentious issues, student loans, even immigration. We managed to put together a bipartisan group in the Senate. But when you get to the budget, it's really kind of the core of the religion of the two parties. You know, for the Republicans, it's no taxes, no new taxes, no new revenues, you know, the Grover Norquist pledge kind of stuff. And on the Democratic side, it's, you know, we can't do anything with entitlements. We've got to protect the entitlements. There can't be any revisions or changes. And the truth is, in my view, that both of those things is going to require new revenues and some work on entitlements, even if we just want to protect the entitlements for future generations. So, but that's what makes it so hard, because each side is defending their, you know, most sacred ground, and that's why we can't seem to get anywhere. But we have to. I mean, we haven't passed a budget in 4 years. It's the most basic function of government. And I think the other thing that people miss down here, they're so concerned about, you know, who's winning and losing. They don't really realize that everybody's losing because the public is disgusted with everybody.
Finally, we're marking the 150th anniversary of the Gettysburg Address. President Lincoln talked about the great civil war our country was in the midst of and the question of whether a nation conceived in liberty can long endure. How do you view that message from President Lincoln today? Do you think it's appropriate or an overreach to compare Lincoln's message to the current climate in Washington?
Well, I don't want to over-dramatize it, but I do think that we're in a period where the functionality of the system the framers designed is being tested in ways that I can't ever recall. I ran into an old college history professor the other day and said, has there ever been a time in American history where government has been less functional and less able to address the nation's problems? And he said, of course. And I expected him to say the Civil War or something. He said, no, the Articles of Confederation before the Constitution was drafted, which I thought was an interesting and somewhat scary insight. I do think we're at a time of extraordinary testing of whether our system can still serve the public's needs. Lincoln, you know, did an amazing thing at Gettysburg. That line, a nation conceived in liberty, which you mentioned, but then he went on to say, and dedicated to the proposition that all men are created equal. That's not in the Constitution. Of course, it's mentioned in the Declaration of Independence, but that was a kind of turning point in American history about, you know, just what is this country all about. And I certainly think those words have as much power and validity today. And I think the underlying premise of the speech, which is this is an ongoing experiment. We've got to keep renewing the promise of America from generation to generation. And we can't just assume that because it worked for 100 years or 200 years or 47 years that it's going to continue to work. We have to continue to work at it and to make it function as it was designed by the framers and envisioned by everyone from starting with Jefferson through Madison and on through Abraham Lincoln. So we are still trying to build a more perfect union, and we're not there yet.
Angus King, independent senator from Maine, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you. Delighted.
And as I mentioned, it's 150 years to the day since President Abraham Lincoln delivered the Gettysburg Address. Later this hour, does Lincoln's message to America still endure?
This is a speech that isn't just about 1863 or the 19th century or the Civil War. It's about the purposes and obligations of the American nation and American citizens.
We'll talk with Harvard University President Drew Gilpin Faust about Lincoln's message to the country and its meaning today. Add your voice. 8778-MY-TAKE is the number. You can also find us on Facebook at facebook.com/thetakeaway.